While women in Hollywood are standing up for themselves, girls in Iowa City are learning the ABCs of filmmaking. This hour, an animation camp for girls and genderqueer youth and a celebration of female filmmakers. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, women in film. We'll find out about a camp that might be inspiring future female filmmakers, a month-long celebration of women in film, and talk about equality in Hollywood. Later in the hour, I'll talk with Rosina Bierbaum. She was the science advisor during the Clinton and Obama administrations. We'll talk about how science and policy collide and her recent trip to Antarctica. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk with Rosina Bierbaum. She was a science advisor during the Clinton and Obama administrations. We'll talk about how science and policy collide. She'll be speaking at Iowa State University on Thursday of this week. But first, through Me Too and the Time's Up movement, women in Hollywood are speaking out against sexual assault and sexual harassment. They're also starting important conversations about equal representation on screen and behind the cameras. We'll talk about this moment for women in film, but we're going to start with what might be the next generation of female filmmakers. Last week, Film Scene in Iowa City hosted a two-day animation camp for girls and genderqueer youth ages 9 through 13. They learned different animation styles, how to work with iPads to create movies, and they even premiered their work for friends and family at the end of the camp. Our producer, Emily Woodbury, visited the camp while they were working on making collages, and she spoke with some of the attendees about why they were there, what they were hoping to learn, and their hopes for the future.
My name is Evelyn Burgess. I am 12 years old, and I'm from Iowa City.
And what brought you to this camp?
I think it's really important for women to be empowered, especially in the filmmaking industry, because women are usually they are thought of as less than men. And I think that in the film industry and with animation, that it's really important to empower women and raise them up.
And can you think of any examples that where you've kind of seen that come into play, the representation of women in the industry, kind of, you know, bringing a positive change? Or
I think the movie Black Panther was a really fantastic representation of strong women, as well as other races being represented, because that was, in our current society, it's really important to have that happen and get that message across to everyone.
How would you describe a strong woman in a film? What makes a character a strong woman?
I think what makes a strong woman is when she does it herself and they don't show like any help that she's either mentally or physically strong, whether that be that she can solve a math problem that's difficult and others have trouble solving, or that she can do amazing stunts.
I'm Fiona, and I'm from Iowa City.
And what are you hoping to learn through the next 2 days?
Well, since I like to animate, I'd like to learn how to make some different things that I can, like, show my friends and family.
Have you animated something before?
I did a stop-motion animation about, me and my friends did this, about a tree being planted, and, like, it went through the different seasons and stuff.
Awesome. Well, thanks for talking with me, Fiona.
Thank you.
I'm Lucy, and I'm from Iowa City.
And what are you working on right now with your collage?
I'm working on something about myself. I like to eat and drink. And so right now I'm cutting out food from a food magazine. and gluing it down. And I have some words that say food and drink up here. And then I also like movies. That's why I came to animation camp. And so when my dad signed me up, I got really excited that I would get to be here and spend time working with animation and stuff like that.
Hi, I'm Amelia Douglas, and I'm from Coralville, Iowa. Well, I like trying new experiences, and also I have done animation before, and I've actually fallen in love with it. So, yes, I love all kinds of art, and animation is definitely one of them.
So that's surprising to me. So you're the second person, or maybe third, that said that they've done animation before. And how old are you?
I'm 12.
Cool. Tell me about the animation you've worked on.
So I've done all types of animation. I haven't done film animation before. Well, I have, but it wasn't really this type of film animation. It was more of like an online thing. But I have done flip books, you know, where you make an optical illusion as you're flipping past through a book. And then I have also made stop motion animation, which I love doing. And I cut out pieces of paper, and then I just move them every, you know, few seconds. And I also have done drawing animation, and because I love doodling and drawing. So, yeah, there's all types of animation that I've done. I just can't remember all the names.
And do you use a phone to film that, or what kind of equipment do you have?
So for stop motion animation in particular, I use this app called Stop Motion Animation, and you can download it on your iPad or your iPhone. Sometimes I do it mostly on my iPad, but, you know, I also equally do it on my phone. So, yeah, it's very interesting how it works, because you can adjust how you would like it. You could add special effects. You could add like a subtitle. You could add anything you'd want. So it's, yeah. I would encourage people to try it out.
Those were a few of the voices of what could be the next generation of female filmmakers. They attended a two-day animation camp for girls and genderqueer youth ages 9 through 13 at Film Scene in Iowa City last week. And Rebecca Fons is here with me now. She's the programming director for Film Scene in Iowa City. She also recently worked very hard to rehabilitate and reopen the Iowa Theater in her hometown of Winterset and is in the midst of a month-long celebration of women in film at Film Scene. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me. I'm wiping away tears from that segment. I feel like the world's going to be okay, you know, when I hear those voices. It's really wonderful.
Well, tell me what inspired the idea for holding this camp.
So we, last fall at Film Scene, we sort of were in the midst of the Me Too, Time's Up, Harvey Weinstein. All of that stuff was sort of in the conversation. And we decided to do a month of films directed by women called Women's March this month. And we knew we wanted to have an educational part of that month. And we have done animation camps before. We do them every summer. We'll do them again this summer at Film Scene. For boys and girls, yes. And so we decided to do one just for girls and genderqueer youth and have a female instructor and make it during spring break. So that works out for schedules and really to embrace those new voices. And some of them are not new voices. Some of them have been animating for a while. But these are the filmmakers and the artists, the young artists that we want to embrace at Film Scene, because who knows, a decade or so from now, they may be the filmmakers that we're putting on our big screen. So as early as we can make these young people film lovers and cinephiles and animators, the earlier they appreciate our space and we can, you know, see them grow as artists.
Well, and Kelly Gallagher came and ran the camp. She's an animator and a filmmaker who teaches at Antioch College in Ohio. She's also a graduate of the University of Iowa. So I know Kelly couldn't be with us today, but tell me a little bit about what she did with the kids.
Kelly was amazing. I mean, she's like our unicorn. We could not have got a better animator and a better camp leader for this. She really worked from the start with the students, talking about how they feel about art and how they feel about themselves as consumers of art and who they are as young people. And so they started doing really basic things, as you heard, making collages, using glue sticks, sort of the basic lo-fi, low-tech ideas. And then from there, they started slowly making small experimental 30-second, 20-second animations with this app called Stop Motion Animation, which is free. And I encourage everybody who wants to encourage their young people in their lives to be creative to try it out. And they some of the films were about the environment. Some of them were about hair. Some of them were about dogs and robots and unicorns. And so she really just let them have a safe and open space to create whatever they wanted to create. And I also give her props because she let the pieces be collaborative. I think it's so important for us to put young people together to lean on each other and build each other up. And so no one made a project by themselves. It was all groups of two or groups of three. It was so fun hearing them say, oh, I really like that idea. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, you said that earlier. Let's try that. Oh, I really like that idea. So that was also very encouraging because she made sure that they were put together and they were thinking in a collaborative sense, which filmmaking is, if nothing else, incredibly collaborative.
The technology that many children have access to today, of course, this is mind-boggling when we think back on our childhoods. But when we were listening to the voices of some of the girls in that piece, it's pretty clear that they've been working with this technology for a long time. How do you see that changing the landscape?
I think it's terrific. I mean, it does make me feel incredibly old. I agree. I'm like, wow, the flip book thing. I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember
right,
flip books.
We drew little pictures and flipped pages.
Yeah. But I think, access is incredibly important for opportunity. With access, you get more opportunity. And so the fact that these young people, both in our spring break camp and in our summer camp, have kind of a comfort with picking up an iPad, and then there are apps that give them this access that are free or very, very low cost. That does mean that I think more young people think creatively and have these creative outlets. So I think that's terrific. I mean, some people would argue, oh, everyone's making movies. You can make a movie on your iPhone and it's, the slow degrade of quality or something. But I think it's great. I mean, anything from like a Instagram video to a Snapchat video, it's people creating and expressing themselves. And so I think that access will give us a lot more content as we continue on. And there was a worry Kelly and I were talking about, will these kids know how to use the iPads? And within 30 seconds, we were like, oh, we're going to be okay. And I love that you can hear the jazz in the background. Like, that was by request. Like, they were listening to Hamilton and jazz. I was like, this next generation is going to – they're doing a really good job.
Now, a lot of kids do have access to this kind of technology, but there's still a very, very deep digital divide. There are many kids that do not have access. Are you concerned about that and that divide maybe even deepening in this technology age?
I do. And I also do worry about that there's a lot of think pieces and conversation about young girls not thinking of themselves as people who can use technology and engineering. There's a lot of studies about how young girls, that's not where they usually go. They're kind of put sort of the softer sciences. But I think that teachers are getting more hip to sort of using technology in the classroom. And camps like Film Scene's Animation Camp, I mean, from the very beginning, we've always said we're going to use technology in this classroom and make it and debunk it, make it not a scary thing for these students just to pick up an iPad and work on something. So I think it's that we're living in a brave new world, and I think it's just a really exciting thing to think about what they're going to be creating in 10 years from now.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Rebecca Fonts. She is the programming director for Film Scene in Iowa City. When we get back, we'll talk about the month that they're spending celebrating women in film. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, right now, we're talking about women in film. This is a moment when we're hearing a lot about women in Hollywood, with the Me Too movement, with Time's Up. But it's not just an opportunity to talk about sexual assault and sexual harassment. Women in Hollywood are also taking this as an opportunity to talk about equality in Hollywood. And here's a clip from Frances McDormand's Oscar acceptance speech for Best Actress, where she asked the female actresses and filmmakers in the room to stand up with her, calling on filmmakers to contact them for projects in the future.
If I may be so honored to have all the female nominees in every category stand with me in this room tonight. The actors, Meryl, if you do it, everybody else will, come on. The filmmakers, the producers, the directors, the writers, the cinematographer, the composers, the songwriters, the designers. Come on. Ms. Boyne. Okay, look around, everybody. Look around, ladies and gentlemen, because we all have stories to tell and projects we need financed. Don't talk to us about it at the parties tonight. Invite us into your office in a couple days, or you can come to ours, whichever suits you best, and we'll tell you all about them. I have two words to leave with you tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Inclusion rider.
That was Frances McDormand from the Oscars. That was the speech that had everybody talking the next morning. And with me this hour is Rebecca Fons. She's the programming director for Film Scene in Iowa City. And long before Frances McDormand made that speech with the Me Too movement, with Time's Up, Film Scene decided to plan a month-long celebration of women in film. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so it's called Women's March. Perfectly suited for the month and what we're doing. We as an art house cinema and as members of this community of Hollywood and cinema and films, we knew we wanted to do something in response to, as you say, you know, the Me Too movement, the Time's Up movement, sort of the conversation that's happening right now. And we did talk about having discussions about harassment in the workplace and disrespect and levels of inequality. And then we thought, why don't we do something really challenging and really positive? And that would be for a whole month, present films exclusively directed by female filmmakers. And really, instead of sort of bogging ourselves down in the bad acts of individuals, really lifting up these female filmmakers and representing them, the past, the present, and the future of female filmmakers. And so that's what we did. And it was a big challenge, a really fun challenge. And there's so many female filmmakers that we didn't include, that we wanted to include, that maybe in the future, if we do this again, we'll include them. But we really just made sure to make a really intersectional, really equal and diverse month that would present some of the best in female filmmaking.
So when you set out to find these films, obviously, as you mentioned, you had to leave a lot of female filmmakers out. So in spite of the fact that there are far more films made by men, there's still a lot of films made by women to choose from. What was your goal when you started picking which films to share?
Well, I think we definitely wanted to show some history. And so I have a background in film festivals. So I sort of made these little pathways that audiences could find themselves. So we made a program called Pioneers, where we have films from Chantal Ackerman. And tonight we have Daughters of the Dust by Julie Dash and Shirley Clarke's Portrait of Jason. So these are the more sort of seminal works that are way, but throwbacks, you know, but really important in the history and trajectory of female filmmakers. And then we had a program on Monday nights called Pioneers, and these are, Vanguard. And Vanguard are sort of the new voices, and included in that was a Latina filmmaker, a trans female filmmaker, a Japanese filmmaker. And then on Saturdays, we wanted to include local voices because there's so much talent here in Iowa and in Iowa City. So we have a program called Homegrown, which are locally connected in some way, shape, or form to Iowa and Iowa City. So we were like, well, we've got the past, we've got the present and the local, and then we have the future. So we just did our best to make sure no one was left behind. Even though there are certain filmmakers we couldn't include, we wanted to make sure that we gave a great little snapshot. So if you spent, you know, 31 days at Film Scene the month of March, you would leave saying, I think I get a pretty good idea of female filmmakers from way back to what who I'll be seeing on the screens in the next 10 years or so.
So given your background in film, what was your biggest surprise in looking at these different films?
I think two surprises. One was I always knew how much content there was out there, but I think I had to really kind of kill my darlings. I had a lot of like late nights of being like, man, Jane Campion, like I can't fit her in there, but I really want to put Jane Campion there. So that was a surprise, just how much a wealth of material we had to choose from. And then also the huge surprise was just how many people maybe have never seen a film directed by a woman, or they sort of like, oh yeah, I saw Wonder Woman. That was directed by a woman, right? You know, people kind of, it's not normal. It's part of the conversation. So with Wonder Woman, part of the conversation was that it was directed by a woman. With Black Panther, part of the conversation is it's directed by a person of color. So there was a lot of sort of people, this sort of surprised. They were like, oh, wow, I've never heard of any of these films, or, oh, yeah, that was directed by a woman. So seeing the audience interact and engage has been a really interesting experiment and exercise.
Well, and we're at this moment in time with Black Panther coming out, mm-hmm. with A Wrinkle in Time, mm-hmm. which has a diverse cast and a different kind of representation than people might have anticipated with that film. Where a lot of people are talking about representation beyond women. I mean, mm-hmm. we certainly have seen a lot of white women in film for a very long time. So, and you mentioned looking for diversity. How are you feeling about this moment in filmmaking?
I feel very hopeful. And as a patron of the movies, I am right along with everybody else. And I went and saw Black Panther the opening weekend because even though I'm not a huge Marvel fan, I wanted Ryan Coogler, the director, to have my money. You know, I was like, take my money. I want Black Panther to have a really, really great opening weekend. And when it has now surpassed like $1 billion, like billion with a B, I feel really hopeful. And Ava DuVernay, who directed Wrinkle in Time, it's surpassing expectations at the box office. So it's super hopeful to me. I feel very hopeful as a patron and as a film lover that we do have sort of a sea change. But it does feel a little tenuous because, you know, when Wrinkle in Time came out, it didn't get amazing reviews. And it was sort of like, oh, no, you know, it's directed by a woman of color. If it doesn't get good reviews and it doesn't do well in the box office, like, will that be a step back? Whereas Black Panther was this step forward, you know, it was like it made so much money and minority directors can break box office records. But Wrinkle in Time has done so well, and for the most part, critics are like, it's a really great film. Bring your children, bring your families. And so I feel hopeful. I feel like everybody has that sort of sense of, we know there are talented people in all walks of life from different cultures, different ethnicities, different genders, but can they sell movies? And I think ultimately, unfortunately, in Hollywood, that's kind of like what matters. There's a statistic that less than 10% of filmmakers of the 250 best-selling films of last year, less than 10% were female directors. But in the indie world, that's something like 30%. So I think we've all been working really hard, and now like Hollywood's kind of catching up to all the indie people and all the women and people of color who've been working in the industry for a long time.
Well, and Women's March continues at Film Scene, and we're only 2/3 of the way through the month. What are you most excited about in the coming weeks?
I'm super excited about Daughters of the Dust tonight. I love that film. Studied it here at the University of Iowa long ago, so it'll be exciting to see it again on the big screen. I'm super excited. We have a program called I Wish I Was More Like You, and it's a curated program by a group called Vertical Cinema. They're students here at the university, and it's experimental short films by MFA, current MFA students and recent graduates. And then on Sunday, we have the Washington Post film critic Anne Hornaday and an Iowan here at Film Scene to talk about her new film, Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies. And we will also sort of dig into the Me Too Time's Up stuff. That'll be a time for us to have a conversation about this current topic.
Well, Rebecca, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much.
Rebecca Fons is the programming director for Film Scene at Iowa City. Again, Women's March continues at Film Scene. There's also another opportunity to see films created by women and for women. LunaFest is a traveling film festival celebrating, showcasing, and championing women in film. It's traveling to the Englert Theater in Iowa City tonight as a fundraiser for Girls on the Run of Eastern Iowa. Doors open for that this evening at 6 p.m. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Rosina Bierbaum served as a scientific advisor to both the Clinton and Obama administrations. She is a professor of natural resources and environment at the University of Michigan, and she'll be speaking at Iowa State University Thursday evening at 8 p.m. in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union. Her lecture is Science and Environmental Decision-Making, From the Lab to the White House and Beyond. And she is with me now. Hello, Rosina.
Good morning, Charity. I'm very pleased to speak with you.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And I'm curious, with your career as a scientist, when did your work researching begin to transition to cross that line to being someone who helped policymakers make decisions?
Well, quite honestly, I intended to be a lab rat and work on esoteric issues in a beautiful marine setting for the rest of my life. But serendipity intervened, and I won a congressional fellowship at the end of my PhD. And I went to a hearing on Capitol Hill the first day of my congressional fellowship and heard a very pathetic conversation between some of the best scientists on ozone depletion and the Congress. And I had one of those epiphanies that perhaps there really is a role for scientists to translate information into usable information. And if that doesn't happen, all the great work that happens in the ivory tower doesn't get used. And so that led me to a 25-year right turn into science and policymaking, and I learned sort of the hard way how to communicate to policymakers. But it was a very exciting time.
Well, tell me a little bit of your evolution as you learned about communicating with policymakers. I think that many scientists go into their field knowing that they want to do research, that they want to learn, they want to share this information with the world, but they also expect people to believe them and understand the information that they discover. And working with policymakers, I mean, what was the first big hurdle that you encountered?
Well, you are absolutely right in saying that scientists are not great communicators. We tend to add several caveats to every sentence we say and make it very hard for a layperson to understand us. So the first thing was really trying to take the state of science and try to explain it in plain information. So, for example, the first problem I ran into was I was working on acid rain long, long time ago, and some members of the science community didn't even know what it was and said, "Acid rain, that must be a rock group, huh?" And of course it wasn't. But the question Congress asked was, okay, this is an emerging issue. Pollution's moving from the Midwest to the Northeast, and we have to figure out how to incorporate it into the Clean Air Act. So what should we do? Well, the science was very incomplete. We had just a couple of endpoints of how much we thought you might need to reduce sulfur and nitrogen compounds. So we put that information out there and we said, look, here's our best guess. If you want to reduce these emissions, it has to be a big part of the country. You should go for sulfur first. You should go for nitrogen second. And Congress, amazingly, and this is a very different political time, this is the 80s, Congress said, okay, well, that's good. We deal with uncertainty all the time. So they incorporated those ideas of how much to reduce and where, and then spent the next 10 years arguing over who should pay for it and whether high sulfur coal miners should be out of work or whether we should pay for scrubbers, which cost quite a bit of money, and balancing those two eventually led to the Clean Air Act of 1990. And I guess just the bottom line for me was, wow, science doesn't stop policymaking. Uncertainty is what policymakers are used to. So give them the best advice you have at any point in time and make sure that they're going to continue to do the research you need to make a better decision down the road.
When you talk about uncertainty, I think that's one of the things that the public really struggles with when learning about scientific news. Do you feel that's a roadblock in communicating with the public?
Yes, I do think that when scientists talk about uncertainty, they use a very different standard than the average person does. So, for example, in the latest international consensus report on climate change, they said they are 95% certain that human-caused greenhouse gas emissions are changing the planet. And I remember stepping back and thinking, 95% certain? I mean, we buy car insurance for the chance of whatever it is, 1 in 8,000 that we're going to be killed in a car crash. And so I think the level of certainty that scientists feel comfortable saying we're certain about this is very, very different than the average person in the street, the odds that the average person in the street would take to protect themselves against potential high-risk but low-probability events.
Well, and even some of the language of science, for example, the use of the word theory, that's something that trips a lot of people who don't understand science up, right?
That's right. You know, so in the scientific parlance, you know, hypothesis is something you're still testing, and theory is something that's better proven. But of course, those words in, again, popular use have very different meanings. I mean, some of the statistics I've seen recently say that although 60% of scientists believe, no, 60% of the public, the American public, now believe that climate change is real and caused by humans, Only 10% of them understand that the vast majority of scientists, some 97% that work in this area, are absolutely convinced that it's humans, it's bad, it's getting worse, and we really need to attack it quickly. So yes, this lack of understanding, a lack of a science-savvy populace, and the lack of clear-speaking scientists, I think, ends up in kind of a collision course. And we need to help scientists be more clear in speaking to the public, but we also need, I think, to raise the level of public discourse so that we have a more science-literate populace.
Well, and you, having worked with both the Clinton administration and the Obama administration, you were working often with policymakers who would at least ask for wisdom from scientists with the admission that you knew more about what you were talking about than they did. It feels like with a lot of policymakers, there's been a real shift in the willingness to listen to experts.
I think that's right. I mean, it's always been clear in my time in government that science is never going to be the loudest voice, but you have to be at the table. And one of my friends who was President Obama's science advisor, John Holdren, said, if you're not at the table, you're lunch. And he meant that in terms of the science budgets, you know. But it is quite true that you are never going to be the loudest voice. But if a policy is going to be made, it almost always has a science and technical dimension. And so if you can help get it into the right arena of what science says is wise, given everything you know at this time and given everything you don't know, it's going to be a much better policy than one where people simply put their heads in the sand and ignore science. And I think, unfortunately, as you mentioned, that seems to be happening now. There are very few major scientists in positions of power in this administration, and I'm afraid science is not at the table for making very important decisions.
We'll talk more about that in just a moment. I'm talking with Rosina Bierbaum. She served as a scientific advisor to both the Clinton and Obama administration. She's a professor of natural resources and environment at the University of Michigan. She'll be speaking at Iowa State University Thursday evening at 8 p.m. in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union. Her lecture is called Science and Environmental Decision Making from the Lab to the White House and Beyond. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me now is Rosina Bierbaum. She served as a scientific advisor to both the Clinton and Obama administrations. She is a professor of natural resources and environment at the University of Michigan, and she'll be speaking at Iowa State University Thursday evening. Her lecture is called Science and Environmental Decision Making from the Lab to the White House and Beyond. And Rosina, we were just talking about how the relationship between science and news and science and policymaking is shifting. And there have been science advisors to every administration since the Eisenhower administration, I believe. So this is something that both Republican and Democratic administrations have had through history, through at least recent history. Is there a science advisor right now?
Sadly, no. Science is largely absent in the current administration, so there is no science advisor to the president. There is no head of the White House science office. There is no president's council of advisors on science and technology policy. And in fact, top agency heads have questioned the value and validity of science, in particular the Department of Interior and EPA. But more than that, we're actually also seeing science advisory bodies in the agencies being dissolved, both in NOAA and EPA, and many senior science positions are empty. I could go on and on. The phrase climate change is disappearing from websites, as are whole data sets. So as I said earlier, I think pretending problems we don't want to deal with don't exist and not getting scientific input is really not going to lead to long-term sustainability and prosperity. And there have also been some worrisome signs of dismissing sound science. I could give you the example of we've been lifting the bans on dumping coal mine waste into streams. We've removed the grizzly bear from the endangered list. We rejected the science-based ban on chlorpyrifos, which is a pesticide, an organophosphate that targets the same chemical pathways as nerve agents, as sarin. And so, unfortunately, from the top, with no science advisor on down, I see a great loss of science momentum. I do think, though, there is hope as we see cities and states and academia and companies stepping up and the public getting engaged and worried about these things.
Well, and there are many people who have pointed that out, saying, well, you know, with this so-called war on science, we are seeing grassroots efforts really being galvanized.
Yes. I mean, that is what gives me a lot of hope. I mean, so if you look at the communities, the states, the corporate world, and even the investment community, I think they're realizing that we cannot assume the government is taking care of our needs and our future. And I've always thought policymaking is a participatory sport, and I see more people stepping up. I mean, we see, as your previous guest mentioned, people in the streets, and they're in the streets for science, for climate change, for women, for diversity, for immigration, for their lives. And very interestingly, after the president retreated from the Paris Climate Agreement, you saw this massive We Are Still In movement, 2,500 leaders from America's city halls and campuses and state houses and boardrooms. And I think in all, it represented more than $6 trillion in resources and 130 million Americans, with the idea that, hey, we're still going to deliver on the U.S. commitment in Paris and reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. So I think that's a very encouraging thing.
But at the same time, as you were also mentioning, we have seen that policy decisions that had been made with the advice of science advisors in the past are being overturned at an alarming rate. What are your greatest concerns right now? What do you feel are the biggest stakes policy-wise?
So I think this focus on short-term gain and prosperity is really problematic, and that the long-term sustainability of all of our values is actually at risk. I mean, so for example, we are making it really hard for scientists from other countries to come here and for our scientists to participate in international science conferences. And so there is going to definitely be a brain drain that will take decades to replace. I mean, already at Michigan, we've seen, right after the election, we saw a 15% decrease in applications for graduate school and from foreign countries. And I don't know what the number is this year, but I'm sure it's going to be bigger. And I think Canada and some of the European countries are going to benefit. So I would say the long-term brain drain is my biggest concern. But of course, as I've already intimated, I'm quite worried about the relaxation of environmental standards, which are desperately needed for human health, and the linkage between human health and environmental health and societal well-being needs to be made. It's a long-term link, and it's a three-legged stool, as many people say. And so cutting out any one of those legs is going to lead to an unstable stool and an unsustainable future.
Well, I know that you recently traveled to Antarctica. You went with the Rockefeller Brothers Foundation and the Nature Conservancy. And, of course, as a scientist, you were looking around yourself and seeing what's going on in Antarctica. What did you observe?
Yes, I have been lucky to travel to Antarctica four times since 2000, and in the Clinton administration, those budgets for Antarctica were actually under my purview. But yes, this most recent trip in February was in 24-foot seas, quite dramatic. But it is amazing to see the differences even in what has only been 18 years. So climate change is affecting the continent absolutely the furthest from industrial activity, and the ice is melting. And we now actually attribute some of the recent doubling of global sea level rise to melting in Antarctica. But I saw a calving of glaciers into the water. I mean, you hear a sound like a freight train or thunder, and then a giant wall of ice falls right in front of you into the ocean. And the continued loss of ice and sea ice is leading to a reduction of krill, which is the really base of the food chain down there. And so as a result, we are seeing shifts in the penguin species because of the temperature, ice, and krill change. So, for example, this time to Antarctica, I saw absolutely no Adelie penguins the first time. And those are the ones that have the black heads and were featured in Happy Feet, if any of you have seen that. And they're not there. They're heading to colder climes, and they're heading down to the continent. And so I guess it was amazing how this magical and seemingly pristine icy world, which has been a world park declared by nations since 1959, has been impacted by human activities. We truly have a global reach.
So you can actually watch the impact, watch the ice melting. You can see it happening in front of your eyes.
Yes. I mean, we could see the calving of these glaciers right in front of our eyes. Yes.
So when you see something like that happening, you mentioned the word hope a little while ago and some of your hope for the future. But for Antarctica, for the polar regions of the globe, for the species that depend on this ice, is it too late?
Well, I prefer to choose hope. I do believe, though, that we are the last generation that can avert catastrophic climate change, and again, that is galvanizing the community. I think that the melting in Greenland and the melting in Antarctica is accelerating, and people are quite worried that at some point we could reach a tipping point. I know that's a phrase that's overused, but a point at which we could not stop the melting, and that would lead to catastrophic sea level rise over the next, well, it would take centuries, but it would be irreversible. So I hate to say we've hit a point of no return yet, but I think we are, the decisions we make with the Paris Agreement that all the countries of the world, except for the U.S., still want to stay in, is a very serious recognition that time is short and we've got to crank up our ambition every 5 years as the treaty calls for, and we're going to check on each other and verify that that's happening. And I think that there can be tremendous breakthroughs. I mean, we've seen just amazing drops in price of solar and wind and amazing increases in use in just the last few years. I think no one would have absolutely predicted that. We've also seen 100 companies worldwide promise to go 100% renewable, and 50 countries say they're going to be 100% renewable by 2050. So even as things have gotten more urgent, I think the solution side to prevent us getting into catastrophic climate change has been building. And so I think it's just whether we can have enough political will to get those massive emission reductions in place in time to prevent the melting of Greenland and Antarctica and reaching catastrophic sea level rise.
Now, the message there is clear about what we need our policymakers to do and to listen to and to understand about science. But a lot of us feel really helpless. So as individuals, We talked about the strength of these grassroots movements. What do individuals need to do and what can they do?
Well, I would say, you know, I worked for the Congress for 13 years, and each of your listeners can get to their members of Congress much more easily than I could as a congressional staffer. So they do not ignore your calls and letters and complaints. And so I think that is the very first thing. I think also you've got to vote, and you've got to encourage people who are running for office that have the same vision as you do of the future to get in. And I think we are beginning to see, as I said, with there's hundreds of women and hundreds of scientists running for positions all across the country, more than a doubling of numbers than we've ever seen before. And I think that's a very good sign. The other thing is that I think there are plenty of personal things that you can do. And one thing I would recommend is we all, the U.S. per person, emits more greenhouse gases than any other country in the world. There are many of these carbon footprint calculators that you can look at online, and you can figure out in your daily life where most of your greenhouse gas emissions are coming from. And you don't have to get them to zero, but it is very easy when you start looking to figure out, I could get 20% emissions emission reduction by carpooling, by doing all my trips to stores on the same day, by switching out lights, by, you know, so there's plenty of things the average person can do. And I think it's really exciting that now at least some utilities are sending us all the utility bills with smiley faces, letting you know if you're doing better than your neighbors on your energy efficiency. I think that that kind of moral suasion is good, too. So I would say, you know, everything from vote what you believe in to figure out how you personally can reduce your own greenhouse gas emissions is very, very important. Don't believe that a single person can't change the world, because of course you can.
What would you say to people about talking with their children, people who are involved in education? For a lot of kids, they learn about the problems facing our planet, and it's overwhelming. I mean, and can leave them feeling hopeless and helpless, which is not what the next generation needs to be feeling if they're going to make a change, to help with making an impact. What should parents and teachers be talking to their kids about?
Well, I think it is important that children get a very good science education. And, of course, that is when I mentioned how science unsavvy we are. It's not that great. I mean, we're 48th in the world in math and science education, and that's just not good enough. And our high school completion rate is 20th out of OECD. And I think there are a couple of things to bolster math and science in general, but then I'll come back to your climate issue. I mean, one very important thing is I think we have to make science cool. And I was so proud that President Obama brought all the science fair winners and mathletes to the White House, even as he, of course, still brought all the sports winners, it just because he wanted to make science cool. And so I think that's really important. The second thing is that I think getting students involved in actually, and actually K through gray, not just grade school and high school, getting folks involved in taking science measurements and understanding them. So citizen science, which I think you have discussed on this show before, where average citizens can go out and help collect water data in Flint, Michigan, or rainfall data in Dubuque, or count bees in Cedar Rapids, so that actually learning how science works and how you can use it to solve problems can be very empowering. In the case of climate change, I think we do need to be teaching these students early about the problem and how difficult it is, but also about the solutions, which range from better infrastructure to better planning and management of forests and agricultural crops to better understanding timing availability of water. I mean, my goodness, I know in Iowa you have had the 100 and 500-year floods many times. And so as thinking more, as you are, about watershed management and stormwater. So I think teaching about the problem, but also thinking about the solution sets, getting students interested in science, technology, engineering, and math, and trying to help solve the problems is very empowering, as is making science cool. I would say, Charity, that since I teach mainly college and graduate students, this is the issue of their generation. I was dean for 10 years, and I didn't know, but 75% of the students the first year were vegetarian, and I laid out our solstice party foods display, half meat, half vegetables, and all the meat was left at the end. That's for environmental reasons, not for health reasons. So I do think that the next generation is extremely motivated and wants to help. And I think if we empower them with thinking through the solution side early and often, they will be the ones who are bringing these transformational technologies to market in the coming years. So it is a delicate balance, but I can't tell you how exciting it is to see the technologies that are roaring into place in the last 5 years.
Well, in thinking about making science cool, do you have favorite popular science resources that you go to or would encourage other people to go to, as far as magazines, documentaries, that kind of thing?
Well, again, from the college side, the students love TED Talks. I think they just don't like to listen to 45-minute lectures anymore, but they love TED Talks. And I think if it's for the right age group, on the right topic, those can be very empowering. I also encourage people to visit the American Association for the Advancement of Science site, which is the AAAS site. They put out Science Magazine, but they have a lot of information for kids and for K-12. The Union of Concerned Scientists certainly does a lot of helpful information. If you're looking at climate science, there are a number of places you can go to. Skeptical Science is an interesting one, where the top 100 skeptical arguments about climate change not being real are addressed one by one and can give the layperson kind of a simple understanding, but a clear understanding of how to address that. And then, of course, there are a whole spate of environmental groups that do really well in explaining these things.
Well, Rosina Bierbaum, thank you so much.
Well, I really enjoyed it, Charity. Thank you.
Rosina Bierbaum will be speaking at Iowa State University Thursday evening at 8 p.m. in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union. Her lecture is Science and Environmental Decision-Making from the Lab to the White House and Beyond.